Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. She is one of my favorite human beings on this planet Earth, someone that is always standing up and fighting for freedom, liberty, and free market capitalism. Her name is Lynette Zhang. Lynette, welcome back to the show.
It's really good to be here, George, and you know it is a mutual admiration. Absolutely. You're one of my favorites as well.
So we should probably start off by telling people that right now I am in my mechanics waiting room because we're just about ready to do the RV tour of kind of Tucson and most of Texas for the fellow rebel capitalists that want to show up and have some beers and some, I've made sure we're getting Corona beer, by the way, just because, you know, we're throwing that's that little inside joke, but so hopefully guys bear with the audio. We're going to do the best we can. So Lynette, I'd really like to find out kind of what you've been thinking about over the last month or so. What is really on your mind? Like, what do you think is the most important topics, you know, just not only in your own life, but what you're trying to communicate to your audience?
Well, for one thing, I'm seeing the breakdown speeding up because I'm seeing an awful lot of competition between governments and, say, the big tech companies. But actually, even more important than that, what's going on with the chains and how they're broken. And on the one hand, they need people to stop consuming so that they can rebuild those supply chains. But on the other hand, we see the governments that need people to consume so that, because we're a consumer-driven economy. And so I'm seeing a lot of shifting that we're seeing opposing views come together in a clash. That's really what I'm seeing, and it has me very concerned.
Do you think we're able to fix the supply chain disruptions with higher prices if we continue to get more and more draconian regulation? Because a lot of economists, you know, in a free market, as you know, the cure for high prices are high prices.
Right.
But I think through that, I'm like, well, they are in a free market, but if you have the government creating a labor shortage, then you have no people to work. Then the price just keeps going up and up and up, and it doesn't come back down to that equilibrium point because there's no more supply coming online.
Exactly. So I don't think higher prices are going to fix it, and especially since we're seeing massive food inflation. That's not something you can skip buying a shirt, but can you skip feeding your family? I don't really think so. And even with the raising interest rates to battle inflation, you know, we're watching a number of countries that are particularly in emerging markets that are raising the interest rates because that inflation has spiked so much. And yet in many of the advanced economies, they're keeping the interest rates at rock bottom because they're not done yet. Right. They're between a rock and a hard place. So these are the kinds of things that I'm seeing that tell me where we are in the trend cycle, because it's getting more and more brittle.
One thing I'd love to run by you. I spoke with a gentleman by the name of Joseph Wang the other day. He's actually going to be at Rebel Capitalist Live speaking with you, Houston, in January 7th through the 9th. But do you know Joseph?
I don't.
Okay,
I'm looking forward to meeting him.
Yeah, he used to work at the Fed.
Oh,
and
awesome.
He was, check this out, he was in charge of the trading desk at the New York Fed. So he was the guy actually in charge of doing quantitative easing. So he knows the plumbing of the system as well as anyone. And he just came out with a blog post, and I had him on my show to talk about it, where he had this hypothesis where if the Fed raises interest rates to combat inflation, that it could actually exacerbate inflation. And here's his theory. Prior to the GFC, as you know, the money market funding for the banks overnight was more of a, well, more of a free market, and they would just lend to each other, and the interest rate was pretty much determined by the Fed, how many treasuries they would buy and then sell. That provided the liquidity. The more dollars that were out there in the system, the lower the interest rate, and then if they wanted to increase the interest rate, They just sell back those treasuries, take those dollars of liquidity out of the system. And then the banks would lend to each other every night. And then also with that, the cheapest form of bank reserves they could get to increase their balance sheet capacity to lend more was from deposits.
Right, exactly.
Remember that? Remember that? I mean, people probably don't even 100%. Remember the fact that you could get interest on deposits. And what would happen is that delta usually stayed rather consistent. So if the Fed raised rates from, let's say, 3% to 5% or 6%, the interest rate that the banks were paying you on your deposits, on your deposit, your checking account, or your savings account, that would go up by 3% as well, because the banks are always competing for that additional liquidity or those bank reserves to have the reserves on their balance sheet in order right. to create additional loans. But he says, now we have IOER, which you know, that where the Fed is paying the banks because there's so many reserves in the system that they're really not limited. Their balance sheet capacity is almost limitless compared to the demand for loans. Therefore, they're not competing for those deposits. And if they raise IOER or interest on reserves now up to 4%, 5%, since they're not competing for those deposits, the amount they're paying for the liability side of their balance sheet could probably stay at 20 or 30 basis points, but yet they're getting paid more and more and more because Powell or Linnell Brainard is increasing that rate in which they're paying banks. So mm-hmm. that means just more profit for the banks, right. just pure profit right.
for doing nothing,
for doing right. absolutely nothing. And so then his theory is that we have continued problems with the debt ceiling. So Janet Yellen can't issue as many treasuries. Therefore, the banks are going to take all those extra, let's say, cash, quote unquote, that they have on their balance sheet, and they're going to want to buy treasuries because they're getting a little bit of a yield that's higher than the interest the Fed is paying them, even if it's a negative real yield when you factor in inflation. But the only entities they're going to be able to buy them from, because Janet Yellen isn't issuing as many treasuries, is going to be the private sector. And when the banks buy assets from the private sector, that actually increases the amount of dollars that are on the balance sheet of the non-bank entities, the average Joe and Jane and the businesses. Sense. And therefore, this spike in M2 that we've seen go parabolic in 2020 and 21, if the Fed raises rates and this mechanism plays out between the banks and the private sector, with the banks buying treasuries from them, then we could see the amount of dollars in the system chasing goods and services continue to increase exponentially, even if the Fed is raising rates. What do you think about that?
Wow. That is a mouthful, but knowing how the plumbing works and really knowing the Fed is created to take care of the banks. The Fed was not created to take care of the public.
Right, right.
So if that does indeed, and yeah, when a bank buys it from, they create the money to buy it. So that would make that actually makes a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think that would mean for inflation? I mean, well, if you take all these things and kind of put them into a formula, you know, what do we get? What do we get on the other side? Is it just continued stagflation, or how do you see that playing out?
Right. It's never continued stagflation. I mean, I really do see a hyperinflationary depression.
You know, how do you define that, Lynette?
A hyperinflationary where you have massive amount, because really all they do have in their toolbox left is money printing anyway, whether they use this mechanism or they use that mechanism. And so we will see an increase in prices. And yet we're going to not see an increase as much in wages. Wages never keep up with inflation. Right. So therefore, in this K-shaped recovery, the wealthy get wealthier because that's where that money flows to. And then the poor get even poorer. So, and I think that'll expand. So that's why I said, I mean, there's... I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but this is a hyperinflationary depression that...
But when you use that word hyperinflation, are you talking, like, what's your metric there? Is that, does that mean, because I think the technical definition is a minimum of prices going up by 50% per month.
It's not per month, but I could see prices going up 50% a month. because the value of the currency is, I mean, honestly, it's pretty much at zero right now, officially, if you look on the Federal Reserve. And I have never really seen it go down as rapidly, officially, as we're seeing it now. So, I mean, you go down to zero, and what do you have? I mean, that's pretty much where we are. So if the dollars that you have will not really buy you anything, I mean, that's what inflation is. It just takes more and more dollars to buy the same goods and services. Yeah. In stagflation, you have prices going up when you have wages going down. And even though there's been some wage pressure, which there should be, but it never, for the average person, it never keeps up with that inflation. Yeah. So I think, you know, I hate to say this, but I really do think we're going to probably see at least 80, 90% of the population in abject poverty. So that's a depression for sure.
And an inflationary depression.
Yeah.
So that's the demand side. Or when I think about the dollars in the system, I always see that as kind of the demand side of the equation. What about the supply side of the equation? If we have more and more dollars chasing the same amount of goods and services, like you're saying, we see significant price increases. But what about, what if the supply of goods and services actually goes down while the amount of dollars are going up?
Which is exactly what's happening right now. And so rather than the Fed taking on the responsibility of creating this mess, they just say, oh, well, that's happening because of this. So you've got too much chasing. So all that does is enable them to point the finger in a different direction when they should be pointing it squarely at themselves.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, and this takes me back to gold. And I know you're a big fan of gold, very bullish. But I want to ask you about another kind of hypothesis that I heard from Russell Napier. And he thinks that the gold sector, the industry, in the future could be included in this whole ESG movement. So earlier we were talking about, you know, the cure for high prices no longer being high prices because of the restrictions and the government regulation that's preventing more supply to come online. But we know this is definitely happening with coal, with oil, with natural gas to a certain degree, where there's just been no investment into those commodities. And now all of a sudden we're seeing supply shortages as a result. And then what's the net effect of that? Prices skyrocket. So he thinks that in the future that those people who are kind of pushing that narrative could include mining into that, because in their eyes, it's creating a lot of distortions with the climate or carbon emissions. Have you given that any thought? Because that would be very, very bullish to gold. We could see a move like we've seen in nat gas throughout Europe, as an example.
Yeah, well, I actually have heard a lot of companies that are starting to talk about it, like Newmont, et cetera. So that is a labor intensive, but also an energy intensive industry. So they are looking at ways to offset that. Plus, there's going to be more costs with a carbon tax and all the new taxes that are coming in. So, you know, I could definitely, but it isn't. But for me, it's not bullish on gold for that reason, because gold, there's a finite amount of it, period. And we can account for 98% of all the gold that has ever been mined. So, and there is a limited amount that's underground. For me, it's more about the money supply. And it's more about the inflation and the goal to offset that, because at the end of the day, you know, it's used in every single area of the global economy. Right. So that's one asset, and it happens to be a financial asset that has the broadest base of demand. And we know that the price has been artificially suppressed because a rising gold price is an indication of a failing currency. They would much rather have you look over here at something that's easier for them to control and things that are intangible than something that you actually hold on to. You hold it, you own it, it's invisible. Even though I have it in my possession, for all intents and purposes, it's invisible. And so I think that's really where you get the downward. And I think what we're going to see is kind of like a spring, right? you hold your hand on a spring and you suppress it from really going where it wants to go. When that hand gets released, then it shoots in a direction, either up or down. And that is, I believe that's what we're going to see with gold until they do the overnight reset. And then you're really going to see it.
Do you think in this hyperinflation scenario you're describing earlier, do you think the way they instill confidence is going back to a gold standard?
Yeah, that's the way they've done it over 4,800 times. And that's the way, I mean, tell me what else has global confidence and acceptance in money form.
So what would that mean for the United States? I mean, I know supposedly they've got a significant gold reserve. I think China, and correct me if I'm wrong, Russia has also been building their gold reserve that they have with their central banks. So in that world, let's say we could just kind of wave a magic wand and tomorrow they're saying, okay, we have to go to a gold standard. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for countries who have more gold and then countries who have less gold?
Well, what that means is those that really have more gold will have more power and more say, which is why you've seen China, Russia, and India really. I mean, we've seen lots of central banks really accumulating, but they're the holders that have the best chance. In fact, I think it was Russia this year that surpassed us in supposed gold holdings. Don't hold me to that. I don't have it right in front of me, but right. I'm pretty sure that Russia surpassed us in terms of gold in one way or another. So, you know, yeah, they're going to have more power. Those that have less of it, like, I'm sorry to say this, but Canada sold all their gold holdings. I probably would not want to be Canadian.
Yeah, so I guess what I was describing there, what you're describing is basically a Bretton Woods 2.0. At 1944, the dollar is the world reserve currency because we had all the gold.
Right.
And so that made the most sense. So whoever's got the most gold, maybe they try it again where they peg that currency to gold, and then maybe all the other countries peg their currency to the yuan or something, or how do you think it plays out?
I think it plays out more like the SDR, which is already a basket of currencies. They can expand that basket to include, frankly, all of the currencies if they wanted to. Mm. And they would include, which they've talked about, a component of gold. I don't see 100% gold backing, though it certainly could be done because it's just a mechanism of the price of gold in terms of the fiat.
Yeah, right.
But it's more likely that it'll be some level of percentage. And I don't think it'll be a one country's currency. I think they need a more universal, because, everything is a double-edged sword. There are certainly pluses for the U.S. We have absolutely enjoyed a lot because we are the world reserve currency, so we can pay all of our bills in money that we can print. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a huge advantage. But on the other side of it too, that also means that we are basically the central bank of the world, and we have to constantly run a deficit in trade to kind of help balance out the world. So I think this will go more toward the SDRs and the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and then they would put a certain percentage of it in there, and it would probably be a large enough, I mean, as little as they can get away with, but a large enough percentage so that people had confidence mm-hmm. in the currency again, and then you could easily have the local currency like the U.S. dollar in this country along with, you know, it would be really easy for cross-border transactions if you had a currency that was a composition of every currency on the planet.
So does the IMF have quite a bit of gold right now?
They do, because I think they're the third, I could be wrong about this, but I think we're like the third largest holder because all of the countries donate the gold to them.
That's interesting.
So yeah, the IMF holds quite a bit of gold.
And I know they've talked about coming out with a digital SDR. I mean, I think their vision
The SDR is digital anyway, right? There's not a bill or a coin. So yep. The SDR is really digital anyway.
Yeah, it's just I see that from that side of it, but I also see it if you've got a digital currency, that also means that the entity that's using that currency or with the central banks, you know, if they're using that as a reserve asset, then they've got to have an account with the whatever entity is issuing that. And right. Therefore, that's going to give them a little bit more control above and beyond. Or at least they're going to be able to micromanage it. At least they're going to be able to have that all that data coming in real time as far as what the central banks around the world are doing, because now those transactions are going to be on their balance sheet with just the SDR being in digital form without the central bank digital currency, or without being a digital currency by that definition. You know, they might not have all of that data. Therefore, they might be a little less likely to micromanage what was happening in each country. I kind of see it like a step up from what happens at a local level. You know, if we have FedCoin, then although all the dollars are digital right now, that means all of us now have an account with the Fed.
Right.
And so they're able to see right. every single transaction, where now it's a little more decentralized in the sense that B of A or Wells Fargo or whatever is the only entity that sees your transactions right now.
Right. That'll change. But yes, and you are, and you're right. And, you know, keep in mind that the data that, or some of the reports that I've read from the IMF, they want all titles to everything held in digital form. Because that really makes it very easy to spend it globally. So you can have a house in Texas, but it can actually be owned by somebody in China or anywhere else in the world. Yeah. And if the IMF is managing all of those coins, yeah, it gives them a great deal of insight and control over everybody.
Yeah, and I get concerned because I think they're so closely related with the World Economic Forum.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with that.
Chris Martinson, we were talking about this before we started recording, was at an event I did this week in a mastermind group, and he was talking about some of the dynamics there with the World Economic Forum and their kind of Great Reset agenda, I guess we'll call it, and this 2030 thing where you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. I know when that first came out, I was giving that a lot of thought, like how, if we own nothing, you and I, well, then someone has to own the stuff we're renting.
Exactly.
And so that most likely would be the global elite. But I think a lot of people have a hard time kind of connecting the dots. Like, how do we go from where we are right now in the United States to owning nothing? Have you given that any thought?
Oh, I've given that quite a bit of thought. And especially when you read the documents about, you know, and the examples from the IMF about how titles can be held on a coin and then the equity broken down into easily spendable amounts. Mm. So now, and everything is held on your phone, right? Right. And we have really been guided to short-termism. So I see this mug and I want it right now, and I have my phone and I know I have equity on there. I've got money, I can buy it. And before you know it, then people voluntarily spend all of their equity. That's what they've been guided to do.
That's a good theory. Yeah, that's a great theory, Lynn. I've never thought of that.
Oh.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I mean, I'll see if I can dig it up for you. But yeah, I mean, they even have diagrams on how they would get people to do this and everything. So that's how they do it. It may take a bit of time because they have to be patient, but hey, look at how far they've come. And then sometimes you have a crisis that speeds up this shift. But they really don't want you to own anything, and then they control everything. And once they control everything, and you've spent it, so who do you complain to? You made that choice, even though perception management guided you to making that choice. Yeah, that's how they do it. They get you to volunteer it.
How do you think they'll roll out a central bank digital currency in the States?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, they brought that out. They actually set up all of those accounts, the Federal Reserve did, in all of the banks, post offices, credit unions, every place. So they've already opened and announced the FedNow account, even though they don't have the currencies yet. They don't have the CBDC. you know, why do that? They're like 3 years ahead of themselves in this announcement and all of that. So they're already set up. And I think that the way that they do it is by making a deposit of digital currencies and saying, here you go. Now you have to spend it here and here and here, and you can't spend it there or there. But, you know, look at what China did. You give it away, get people used to it. And in China's case, if they're not particularly comfortable with it or they prefer a different digital currency, then you kind of, you know, smash that. So now use of the digital yuan explodes. So I think that's the way they'll do it. Everybody's got a digital account, whether you realize it or you don't, at your bank, at your credit union, and for those areas that are really remote, at the post office, and they just make a deposit, and here's free money. Go
UBI.
Spend it. Yep.
UBI. So every single month, that's the incentive.
That is. You know, that, and they may not go directly to a monthly thing at first. They may just start out with a deposit of whatever, and you have to use it by such and such a date. But that's how they'll do it. They'll give it away, and people go, wow, free money. Okay.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
You probably won't, 99% of the average Americans, you're not going to have to twist their arm for that. If all they have to do is download an app, you know, even you say, well, wait a minute, you might not want to do that. You're going to give all your privacy to the Fed, and, you know, they're not going to care about that at all.
No, all they're going to see is the free money.
What do you think about this gal, Amarova? Have you researched her, any of her ideas?
No.
Okay, so she's this gal, and I forgot her official title. I think a comptroller of the currency or something that. She's someone that Biden nominated. I'm not sure if she's has the job yet or not. I think she does. But she's came out with a paper, and she's kind of expressed all of her ideas. She is someone that is really in favor of a central bank digital currency, first and foremost. But that's not where her, let's say, creative ideas end. She's also someone that's very sympathetic to communism. The communism they had, specifically in Russia. And she's also talked about how we should, or the Fed, the central planners, should micromanage things to a degree which they should actually control the S&P 500. So this is a world where...
Well, I think I'm going to be reading a lot about her after this conversation, George.
Yeah, you probably want to do some videos, because her ideas are just absolutely insane. But they're becoming very popular. And, you know, if this is who the administration is hiring, they're surrounding Janet Yellen. And let's say we have Lael Brainard next at the Fed. So these MMT gals, and then you combine that with Amarova. I mean, this could go south really quick. But going back to that idea she has, or what she stated as what we should have as policy, is if the S&P 500 gets up to a level where the central planners think that it's too high, she actually thinks that the Fed should come in and short the market. And then if it gets too low, then the Fed should come in, or the Treasury, if their balance sheets are combined by this time, And then the central planners should come in and buy the stock market to bring the S&P 500 back up to a level that they think is just perfect.
Oh my God.
I knew you'd get a kick out of that.
Oh my God, George. I mean, I was there in 1987 on Black Monday. I was there, and that's when they came out with the plunge protection team. So look, who doesn't know that the central banks aren't already, I mean, neck deep in managing these markets? But, you know, it always scares me when they get really overt about it, which they did after 2008.
They get arrogant to the point where they just, okay, now we're just going to throw it out there. We don't care who knows about it because this is the agenda and this is what we're doing.
And exactly. I mean, that is really, really, really scary. Because part of it, and this is such a big thing, the stock markets are valued in terms of dollars.
Right.
In this country or wherever that stock market is, it's valued in terms of the government currency. So they can make it, and they already do. They're just not as overt, perhaps. But they already manipulate it to a huge degree. The interest rates, the stock markets, the derivative markets, the real estate markets. I mean, everything is about financial repression and, you know, creating and maintaining those bubbles.
Yeah, yeah. And, so, and think about that too, Lynette, because if they're trying to manage, let's say the S&P 500, what's their metric? Like, is 5,000 exactly too high? Is 10,000? And then you'd have to say, well, it's got to be adjusted for inflation. But what if their measurement for inflation is wrong? I mean, you just think about the unintended. Yeah. So yeah, exactly. If they're using the CPI, then that's going to understate inflation. Therefore, you know, who knows what they're thinking the S&P should be. That's not even going to be the right number, even if they could micromanage it. And then you just think of the unintended consequences and how this further distorts the economy. And then I always go back to thinking, okay, well, does this create an environment where we're making more goods and services or less? Because that's what true wealth is. And you just say, wow, that's a road. That's a slippery slope.
It's a huge slippery slope. And when you really stop and think about it, all you can do is convert those shares that you have into the fiat.
Mm.
So at the end of the day, when people lose confidence in the fiat, in the currency, then what do they go to? They go to tried and true currency.
Mm.
Yeah. Do they want you to be thinking about that? No, no, no. They want you to be electronic. They want you to be intangible. They want you to be things that are easy for them to manipulate. But how can they even determine that? We already don't have a free market. Oh, my God, George.
Yeah, I know I hit you with that one out of right field. Like, I think I rattled you there with that whole.
You did.
With the Omarosa.
That's why I love you, you know.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that, but I'm excited that
I'm glad.
I know you're
going to
dive into it, and you're going to see the horror show that is the Biden administration. And I don't want to pick on them. I mean, it's all the politicians, all the central planners on the right and left. So I've been talking a lot with my audience about how I don't really think it's about right or left or Democrat or Republican anymore, or Republican. It's really about people who value authoritarianism, or they see that as the path forward, versus people who value individualism. Because you've got a lot of people like Brett Weinstein or maybe Joe Rogan who would consider themselves on the left, but they really value individualism. And then you've got people that I think are in the administration who really see the world through a lens of authoritarianism, and then maybe some people on the right as well. So how do you see that in the world and in the United States and even around you in Arizona?
I wish I was not about to say this, but I definitely think that we are going more toward the
authoritarianism, yeah.
Authoritarianism. I'm having a hard time with that word today. And if we don't stand up and say no, that's right. What we're going to get. But I don't need anybody to tell me, you know, how I should live my life. You give me a set of reasonable rules and I will create my life within those rules, because I do think we need, obviously, some set of rules. But I don't need anybody looking over at my shoulder and telling me what I should be doing. And actually, not even so much telling, but forcing.
Yeah, right.
That's what I said.
Coercion.
I mean, it is coercion. However you want to look at it, it is coercion.
I still believe that there are more of us than there are of them. And I hate to say it that way because it makes it sound divisive, but that's, I guess, the only way to articulate it. But I think there are more Americans who still value individualism. So
but you know,
is there a way we can push back with civil disobedience? Is that, or is that,
Well, we're going to have to push back. I mean, usually you push back, you know, you vote with your purse or your wallet, you know, you vote with your votes. But if all the choices are garbage, then, you know, that's kind of hard. So you vote with your wallet. And I think that that's really, you know, we've been trained that the only choices are the ones that are being presented to us by, you know, Wall Street or the government, et cetera. It's not really true. It's definitely not true. But most people have been, you know, I mean, we've been lied to.
You're
since
right.
The day we've been born, we've been lied to. Mm. And I think for those that have such a hard time, you know, they'd have to admit that what they believe to be true their entire lives is a big fat lie. And for most people, that's a hard pill to swallow. Oh, that can't, even in the face of them doing it, they couldn't possibly do that. And that's one thing, you know, when we're talking about the different parts of the world, and I'm sitting there and I'm reading article after article, and those articles are pointing fingers over there and over there and over there, when in reality, we're doing exactly the same thing here. What mm-hmm. makes it different when we're doing it in America than when they're doing it on Australia or China or Venezuela or wherever else? What makes it different?
Yeah, and see, what I was thinking about too is I always look back at the lockdowns, and a lot of people in the Rebel Capitals community, you know, they talk about the importance of the Second Amendment, which I absolutely agree with. But let's just say there weren't any guns. Let's say we lived in Australia for a moment, right? And they had these lockdowns. What would happen if everyone just said no?
Exactly.
If you're supposed to, you got 4 million people in Phoenix. The government comes in, and yes, there are police officers, or maybe they have the military, and maybe they do have a tank or whatever. But you got 4 million people. What if just all of them say, you know what? I'm not going to lock myself in the house. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to go outside. I'm not going to play by your rules. If all 4 million people did that, is there really anything they could do?
Not a thing. And, you know, you might find, like we've seen in France or some other countries, that when the police or the military are faced with this wall of just normal, average people saying no, what do? They put their weapons down and they join the people.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
I mean, that's huge. And we've seen that. And I just got chills. But, you know, I think we'll see more and more of that. But that is exactly what you do. You say no, and you live your life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the story that Gerald told us, our good friend Gerald Celente, about how the Berlin Wall came down. It's just the people had enough. They went out there as a group, and there was thousands of people for every one guard. So what are the guards going to do? They're going to put down their guns.
Exactly. And I hope, I mean, we are seeing that happen. So I feel like we will see that happen again. And you're right, because we do have to stand up and say no. Who? I mean, seriously, who died and made them king?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, they're trying to assert themselves as that in that position.
And when you're talking about I'm having such a hard time with that word today, authoritarianism, what makes them, they're human beings, they're not gods, they are not all-knowing, They are fallible human beings, and they have their own agendas that support what's in their best interest. Are they really looking at your best interest and my best interest and the population's best? No, that's the way they'll spin it. But there are so many things that I'm seeing that are not in the general public's best interest.
Yeah, I think that people need to try to put themselves just momentarily in the mind of someone that is for central planning. Let's say you're someone who believes in central planning. We should have more government control. That, if you really think through the premise of their logic, in air quotes, it's really there are some people that are just smarter than others, or better, or maybe genetically superior to others. And they need to have all of the power and control because everyone else is just too stupid or inferior to make their own decisions. And therefore, if we should try to usurp as much power and control as possible for the greater good, because those people left to their own devices are going to make stupid decisions and just destroy the planet, destroy the economy, destroy society. You see, it's a sociopathic approach and look at the world. But if you're a central planner, that's pretty much, although they probably wouldn't admit that, and maybe they've never even thought about it that way, but that's what you're standing up for, is just basically this idea that there's some people that are just superior to others, therefore they should take the freedom and liberty away from those people who they deem to be inferior. And that's a slippery slope.
Kind of sounds like Hitler.
That's where I'm going with that, because that idea is really based in eugenics.
Yeah, it is. And it's disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do we, or what else can we do to push back? And where I'm going with that specifically, Lynette, is I was with Chris Martinson. I hung out with him a lot this weekend, and he's someone that really promotes the same type of ideas that you promote as far as self-sufficiency. And we talked about how at the end of the day, you know, money is just gold, and that may be true, but I think wealth is just goods and services, or more specifically, food, energy, and shelter. And water. There you go. So what can people do to really make sure they're building an environment around them where if we have a disruption in the supply chain for one of those key ingredients, that they're going to be able to take care of themselves and their family? Because I know that's something that Chris is really trying to promote as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, we have to take, you know, I mean, I think this is really where community comes in.
Yeah.
Because when you're just by yourself, like, people will come in, you've come to my property and you're like blown away. But the reality is even though I'm the one, exactly. And, you know, even though I'm the one constant that's been there since I started this project in 2010, I have had a lot of help. And you also met my farm workers and everybody else here. So it takes a village. It really does. And I think that that's coming together with like-minded people at the events like you have and at other events, that, I mean, that's what we need to do. You're because right. You need to make sure that you have all those things really put in place: food, water, energy, security, barterability, wealth preservation, community, and shelter. And, you know, I kind of lump medicine in with food, because if you have a chronic illness that requires some kind of ongoing medication, these are the things that no amount of gold is going to be able to buy you if they're not in the country, period, end of discussion. Now, if they are and you can get them, well, then all you need is enough money to do it, right? So, but I mean, it's critical. So I think we all look around, and I know for me, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? And you just look at, where am I most vulnerable? Where do I feel that I'm really, really vulnerable? And then you start to support that area so you no longer feel vulnerable there.
Right.
And of course, you know, food and silver, in barterability, the difference between gold and silver and anything else is that gold and silver do not have a shelf life, and they are universally recognized and accepted. And so that makes that barterability piece a whole lot easier. And it also means that, you know, during these kinds of shifts, like you said before, you own nothing and you will be happy, except that somebody owns everything then.
Yeah.
And so personally, I would rather be one of those that own everything and get to say, okay, this is the rent, than the one that has to say, how much is the rent? Can I pay that or not?
And maybe even further, that you're not dependent upon those people who want to take us that direction.
Exactly. And you know, so that's why gold and silver for me is the very foundation of my portfolio. It is certainly, you know, I'm all in. I know I'm missing runs here and runs there, except that I think about fiat money differently than pretty much anybody else that I know, to be honest with you.
Right.
And, you know, how much do you really want to hold on to? No. I'd much rather hold real money. But as you know, I have all of those other things in place. You haven't been to the bug out house yet. We have to make that.
Yeah, that's the next step. How long would it take for someone to build a sustainable or maybe a self-sufficient life to where they weren't dependent upon the supply chains and the central planners and the economic distortions they're creating, or they're not dependent upon them making good decisions in the future? Like, let's, if I came to you and said, Lynette, I just bought 100 acres up by, you know, by your property. How long, and let's say I've got four people in my family. It's me, wife, two kids. How long would it take me to get that to a, not perfect, not to where your place is now, but just to a level to where we could, you know,
survive.
Yeah, exactly.
And all of that. You know, part of it does depend on how much you have to work with. You know, you have to buy
financial resources. Okay.
Exactly. So financial resources are really critical. But I actually asked that question to my farmhands here just the other day. I said, okay, because we're the next step for us, and the I'm not going to say the final one because I'm never finished, but the last piece that I need up there to make me feel secure is the food part. So I said, okay, we're building these hoop hothouses, these geodesic dome hothouses up there. From the time that you plant to the time that we can start eating from that, how long is that going to be? Because I need to plan dry food to weather over that, right? And so they said that probably about 3 months. It would take about 3 months. You can do a little bit of harvesting before that, but about 3 months. So that's how much dry food. Now, the other thing that I'm going to say,
your chickens too, but your chickens, that would be almost immediate, isn't it?
If once they're 6 months old, yeah, the chickens will start laying eggs. I have meat chickens. Those take about, I think, 6 to 8 weeks. They take about 8 weeks, Edgar. 6 to 8 weeks for meat chickens. So, yes, there are some things that you can do. If you have a goat and the goat has a baby, you're going to get milk right away. So there are some things that you can do that are faster. But again, it boils down to, you're going to buy a more mature chicken instead of a little chick for $3 or $4 or $6, however much they are. Then you're going to have to buy a pullet, you know, so a chicken that's about to produce. And that is probably about, I think those, don't hold me to this because I don't really handle this area, but I think as compared to about, you know, $4 or $5, they're probably about 15 or 20.
Okay.
So, well, no, but it's all relative. It's all relative. So, I mean, and it's the same thing with the tilapia in a tank, right? You can get bigger tilapia. They're going to cost you more to lay it in. But you get a larger male and female, then they start to have babies. So you get to eat them sooner.
Yeah.
So, you know, the sooner you start, the better off you are. And we're working on actually putting together like a minimum level, right? Because you
At your next property, right? Or at the big property?
It's the the bug out property.
Yeah, that you're talking about creating a minimal level right now at the bug out property. So that's kind of the process that you're in.
No, the bug out property fortunately is like done. I mean, that's at the max, but I mean for most people.
Okay.
Because not everybody's got different level of resources.
Right.
And so we just feel like we need to come out and say, okay, this is the amount of water and you can generate it this way and it'll cost you $1,500. And this is the level of this and, you know, it'll take this long and it'll cost about at this today's prices this much, et cetera. So that, you know, if you don't have great means, but you still need it, doesn't matter whether you have lots or you have a little. There's always a way to create that food. Like, not everybody is going to plant out their yard or even have a yard to plant in, but maybe they have the size of a shelf that they could work with. Well, they could put in an aquaponic system there. Would it feed a family of four? Probably not, but it would feed one person really well. You know, you can put your lettuce and tomatoes and different things like that. So you can have some live food. If you don't even have that space, and that would probably, we're going to do that actually in Jacqueline's backyard. We're going to put in an aquaponic system, but just a tall tower, just a small little unit. Mm-hmm. So people, and we'll film it, so people will see how to do it and also have the pricing on what it takes. And, you know, again, once you put in the plants, then you can start to gather the seeds. So right. You might have to spend a couple bucks on the seeds to get started, or maybe your neighbor has some, or I know I give away a lot of seeds. But once you get that going, then you want to keep it going, and it's a whole lot less expensive. You know, but there's all different levels on which you can work and do it. I'm planning on 35 people.
What would you do? Because I think this community component you touched on is extremely important.
It is.
And I used to not emphasize it as much because I was very kind of a lone wolf type of person. I would just kind of wanted to be left alone, and I had quite a bit of confidence in my own ability. So I'm like, I'll just handle it myself. But now that I kind of have a mastermind group, and I meet people like you and like Kenny and Chris Martinson, and you know, all these people, I'm like, but this has brought so much incredible value into my life, and it's made my life so much better than it was before. But I'm thinking that a lot of people in my community, and probably your community as well, they feel like they're all alone. Mm-hmm. Because they have these ideas, they believe in freedom, they believe in liberty, they believe in free market capitalism, they believe in sound money, they believe in individualism, but all of their friends around them, you know, maybe they live in California, and it just feels like they're all alone on this island, and they don't have, although there may be people around them, there are no like-minded people around them, and they get very frustrated. And they get to a point where it kind of sucks all the energy out of them. And they say, well, I hear Lynette talking and George talking and all these people, but it just feels like this is kind of hopeless, right? And then you get bombarded with all their friends on Facebook saying the exact same things, that they're crazy, that they're whatever, you know, domestic terrorists, or you're not following the science or whatever it is. If you had to start from scratch, mm-hmm. and I just dropped you right in the middle of San Francisco or some crazy town like that, how mm-hmm. would you start to build your own community? So what advice could you give to that person? You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. And the first thing that I would do is find community gardens, because you're more likely to find more like-minded people. And then I would just keep going to them until I found the group that resonated with me. Mm. So that would really be probably the very first place that I would look. Okay. In the middle of San Francisco, or in the middle of New York City, or in the middle of anywhere, you know. And the second place that I would look would be meetup groups. So if you go online, you can put in what you're interested in, and there's probably a meetup group of like-minded people. Mm. So those that believe in this, that is a great, that's actually how I got started with the aquaponics, I came across this meetup group called Garden Pool, and I went to their first event, and they had like probably 35 or 40 people there that gathered at this one woman's house. It was in Carefree, and we dug out a tilapia pond. Everybody just volunteered their time and everything. Cool. It was so incredibly cool. And hey, when I started this property, there were probably, I think maybe about 68 people that showed up on a Saturday morning. And, you know, I fed them and I had all the materials, but they planted all the trees. They dug out the tilapia pond. I mean,
was that from the meetup group?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. That is really cool.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are two just right off the top of my head, really easy places to find like-minded people.
Mm. Well, and that is a fantastic segue for me to go ahead and remind everyone that I am on an RV tour for Rebel Capitalist community people who follow the channel or follow your message or my message. Anyone can show up. It's totally free. Tonight we're in Tucson, El Paso. Next night, Dallas. That. You can go to georgegammon.com/events. And we've got an RV. We're just going to be at a campground doing barbecues and beers for anybody who wants to show up and talk about freedom, liberty, and free market capitalism. So that would be a great group of people to meet in your local area that are like-minded. And so if you're feeling alone, you can come there and really meet some people that will support you and help give you that energy you need to continue to fight back.
Yeah, because we do. I mean, I'm sure you've experienced this, but, you know, when I'm driving around Phoenix, there's so much construction going on. And, you know, I could see how people go, what are they talking about? Things are fine. Look at how business must be booming. They're building all over the place. Mm. And yet we look at the underbelly and we see what's really happening underneath that.
It's all artificial.
All of it. And built on a mountain of debt.
Mm, right. Right.
So I think that's great that you're doing that. It really supports the community because we do. We all have different gifts, different talents, different knowledge base. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as one person, can you really do all of it? As wonderful and strong as you may be, I think it takes a village, which is probably why I'm really planning on like maybe 35 people up in my little compound at my bug out.
Yeah.
Because I can't do it all myself.
Right, right.
Nor do I want to.
Well, the next RV, assuming this is a success, the next RV tour will be myself and Lynette Zhang. We will both be in an RV touring the United States.
My God, George.
And we'll have our little aquaponics thing in there.
Well, we could travel with the aquaponics. We actually could do that, and we could talk about. It's hard for me to say no to you because I love you so much.
Well, let's start with Houston. We'll remind everyone that both of us are going to be in Houston at the Rebel Capitalist Live. You're going to be speaking there again. That's January 7th and 9th. So check that out. Lynette, for my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you're doing, where can they go?
Well, they can go to the YouTube channel, and so they can either put in ITM Trading, or they can just put my name in, Lynette Zhang, and it'll come up. But they can also go to the website, itmtrading.com. And, you know, we love face-to-face, and we love real communication with real people. So you can do as much as you want, you know, over the computer, but we're really here to be of service. All of us are here to be of service because these are very different times that we're living in right now. We need to be a community.
Yep. Very, very true. As and always, RV, it was a pleasure speaking to you. We're going to do that, RV. We're going to do that. Leave us a comment right now and say, let us know if you would like to see Lynette and me do an RV tour across the United States, and then I'll share all those comments with Lynette. But thanks again for your time. I can't wait to have another conversation soon, and we'll see you in Houston.
Absolutely, and I hope I see you before that.
Yeah, okay. Bye, Lynette.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist Show, I guarantee you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist Show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.